Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Cleaning up contaminants in drinking water is a priority in many communities across the nation, and a University of Delaware professor believes he has a solution to deal with one of them.
The technology can be employed at medium to small scale water treatment plant.
We talk to UD's Dr. C.P. Huang about his solution to drinking water contaminated with perchlorate. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Our arts playlist introduces us to the author of a new book about Harrington, Delaware's history. And we have the latest episode of the Direction Democracy podcast from UD's Center for Political Communication. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Environmental Protection Agency sought public input last summer on several options for possible regulation of the drinking water contaminant perchlorate, years after it determined perchlorate meets Safe Drinking Water Act criteria for regulation. The substance used in rocket propellants and fireworks has been shown to affect thyroid function. According to the EPA, perchlorate has been found in public drinking water systems to the degree that it presents a, quote, public health concern. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talked with an environmental engineer at the University of Delaware about technology he has developed to remove this emerging contaminant from drinking water.
Dr. C.P. Huang is a professor in UD's Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. He's been studying ways to remove perchlorate from drinking water for years and has recently patented a membrane that selectively filters perchlorate from water. He's also working to patent a second process that breaks perchlorate down to make it less harmful. Dr. Huang, thanks so much for being with us.
Really, thanks for having the opportunity to talk to you about the water quality issues.
So let's just start off with the basics. What is perchlorate and how does it get into water supplies?
Perchlorate is an ionic negatively charged oxygen-containing chlorine. And it has a relative high oxidation power, right? And where we get the perchlorate from, usually the 90% of the perchlorate in water or in the environment coming from the rocket fuel, right? About 90%. The other few percentage of the perchlorate in the environment coming from like you light a match, right? Or the flare, or the raw flare when you have a car accident, people put a flare in. That also has a perchlorate salt in it. And also the firework, that also has a perchlorate, but it's very small percentage of the perchlorate coming from those sources. 90% of the perchlorate is coming from the defense industry. They use the ammonia perchlorate as a rocket fuel. And if the fuse expires, then they usually just, all day we just open dumping, sort of. We saw that that's not very toxic or not very harmful chemicals. It's only had ammonia and perchlorate. Until the National Academy of Sciences had a study and found out that the perchlorate is going to cause, at a low, relative low concentration, would cause thyroid gland cancers. And in American, the National Academy of Sciences, according to their calculation, for this is how they calculate the minimum doses. I use a 70 kilogram adult, and I'm taking 200 cc of water a day, right? And during a lifetime exposure, they can come up with a 4 ppb, 4 parts per billion of concentration, which is very low. I mean, that's many laboratory cannot even detect perchlorate at that low concentration. Our laboratory, we are able to analyze, detect perchlorate at that 4 or 5 ppm concentration.
So how widespread is perchlorate contamination in, I guess, drinking water, fresh water?
As far as the spreading of the perchlorate in the water is concerned, it's not really an issue at this point. The concentration really is very small in most of the surface water that has been reported to have perchlorate in it. Usually it's less than 1 ppm, as one per minute, which is still a very small concentration. And it's not really widespread in the whole U.S. country. I mean, it's only local regions, such in Arizona, California, in southwest, and in northeast, USA has a relative high concentration of perchlorate in groundwater or in surface water. But it's not at the dangerous level, alarming level.
Has it been found in drinking water supplies in Delaware?
No, but Delaware, from EPA, U.S. Geological Survey data, Delaware is not a place where you will see much perchlorate in our water bodies.
So you've been working on, and you recently patented, a membrane to basically remove perchlorate from water. So can you explain how it works and how you got there?
The technology that we developed actually consists of two sub-technologies. The first one, where we got a patent from, was a membrane. And the next one, which I'm in the process of publishing the result and also try to get a patent later, is on how to destroy the perchlorate into less toxic chloride ion. So the reason to need to have this membrane in integrate into this total system is because when we try to decompose or destruct the perchlorate into chloride is by using electrochemical methods, which is the higher the concentration, the faster the reaction will proceed. But most of the, as I just mentioned a few minutes ago, most of the water that has perchlorate in it, the concentration is very low, about 1 ppm with 1,000 of ppb, right? So that is really very low concentration. So it's very difficult to destruct, to break down the perchlorate into chloride by any means. So in order to increase the concentration, we have to concentrate the perchlorate by 100 times or 1,000 times. And then we apply our electrochemical method to break down the perchlorate into harmless chloride. And so the membrane has that purpose, is to concentrate from regular water has a low concentration by about 100 to 1,000 times, just to make our second stage electrochemical destruction process work faster and more effective.
So in that, can you just remove, like physically pull it out of the water through the first part of your method? And is the second something, a treatment you would do within a water source, or is this after you've removed it?
The first step of the treatment is to take a water and you put it in a water tank, and then there's a membrane. We put our membrane in between two electrodes. And we also apply a low voltage where the perchlorate will be transported from the toward the positive electrode, right? And passing through this membrane and then be collected in the other side of the membrane, which will be concentrated. The thing is, this is a special unique property about this membrane is it only lets the perchlorate pass through. The other minerals such as chloride, nitrate, and sulfate, which are not necessarily harmful, will let behind. So we only let the perchlorate pass through the membrane, and then being concentrated on that chamber we call the cathodic chamber, on the other side of the membrane, and then in that chamber we put our other two electrodes to break down the perchlorate into chloride, and so it can be operated in a continuous basis, in and out, continuously, right? And so water come in with the perchlorate after separation and treated with the two electrodes, and then when it's go out, it's all in the chloride form.
So how expensive is this? How, like, realistic is this? Is this something we could see in, like, a municipal water treatment plant down the line, or is this a very specialized, high-tech procedure?
The technology actually is not expensive because the electricity, the current is very only a few volt. It's not a high voltage operations, and so the energy consumption is almost minimum. Secondly, we do not add any other chemicals, and so the technology can be employed at medium to small scale water treatment plant. Medium to small means household, university, hospital, or those small water drinking system. that can be easily adapt with our processes. And for water treatment plants, I would say for a medium-sized but community-based water treatment plant to apply this technology actually is quite feasible, because it can almost operate the system without much attention, automatically operated, and you can have a sensor to check for when to change the membrane and when to change the electrode. So it's not an expensive technology.
So what are the next steps to get it there?
The next step to get there, if the EPA will start to regulate seriously the drinking water standard of perchlorate. But right now, EPA has not really formalized this drinking water standard for perchlorate. Right now, there are 13 states, I think it's about 13 states in the countries have the drinking water standard on perchlorate. And it varies from, the National Academy of Sciences proposed to a 4 ppb, but that number keep changing, right? And sometimes go to 80 ppb, some go to 16, 20. So it's a range of concentration. I mean, California, Texas, New Jersey, Maryland, Massachusetts, and a few other big states, they have the standards on perchlorate in drinking water, but not all of them.
Do you think the sort of regulatory patchwork right now with the states has to do with the fact that you said it's not really a problem across the country? It's more just in places, I'm presuming, where there's defense industry activity?
It's probably true. As I say earlier, the problem with perchlorate is not widespread issues. And since the other thing, the concentration is generally really quite small, quite trace, so it's not much of a concern at this point.
Now that it's been identified, you said that one of the original problems was there was dumping because we thought it was fine. But now that we know that's not the case, do we expect it to get only better, or is it an emerging contaminant because it might actually get worse?
Yeah, I'm very optimistic about the future problem of the perchlorate. I think now we know more about the problem of perchlorate, the health issue of perchlorate. So right now we don't just open dumping. Yeah, mm-hmm. So that has been taken care of. Yes, so not to worry about it.
Thanks to UD researcher Dr. C.P. Huang and R. Sophia Schmidt for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, our latest arts playlist, where we meet the author of a new book chronicling the history of Harrington, Delaware. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A Harrington author has written a new book allowing readers to take a step back in time. Harrington Through Time, a hometown story, was written by Douglas Poor, a lifelong Harrington resident and public servant. It's the second book in a series Poor has written, and in this week's Arts Playlist, he speaks to Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about it.
Today, we are talking to Douglas Poor. Doug is a lifelong resident of Harrington. He spent his life as a public servant. He's also a member of the Volunteer Fire Company and a recently retired paramedic of some 30 years. And today, Douglas serves as the curator for the Greater Harrington Historical Society. Now, having always had a passion for some history, he's taken on his new role with the same zeal that he used as a public servant, and he's written a book. So what is the name of this book? And take me back, what inspired you to even think about writing a book?
The book is called Harrington Through Time, and I've seen other similar paperback books such as this in different bookstores that highlighted different small communities and other events that have happened around our country. And our town is very rich in history. It's our 150th anniversary here in the city. So it kind of all flowed together to motivate me to share our town story.
Well, talk about some of that history.
Well, the town was actually founded way back in the late 1600s on a land grant by William Penn. So, of course, we're going way back in time when the grant was done. And then it stayed just a little small country crossroads until the railroad came to town, which changed a lot of this state. The whole peninsula saw huge increases in population, in money, It's amazing if you go to some of the small towns, I'm talking 500 people up and down the railroad tracks in on the Delmarva Peninsula, they have banks that at one time would see, it wasn't uncommon for $5 million to run through one of these banks at the peak of agricultural season around the 1900s.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and our town was certainly in on that between the number of canneries, because everything used to be canned before frozen foods came along, and garment industry. So this town has seen a lot of history roll through it, for lack of a better description, with the railroad. It started as a stagecoach stop. So it's been a transportation hub since it was created. And I wanted to just share that with people that lived here maybe most of their life and didn't realize it, or new citizens that have come to town.
All right. Now, I was raised never to ask a man his age, so I won't ask you your age. But you are a lifelong resident of Harrington, and you just outlined some of the changes that happened in Harrington over the years. Name some others. I'm sure there are many, many more.
It's an amazing. By the way, I'm 56. I don't care. it's an amazing change that us, as any small town America. Back in the 20s and 30s, they were very self-sufficient. There was no World Wide Web. You couldn't shop on Amazon. You didn't go to Walmart. These towns were all self-contained. There at one time was both an opera house and a large movie theater here. The owner of the movie theater was renowned up and down the East Coast as being the guy who was always on the forefront, first to have air conditioning, first 3D movie shown in the state of Delaware. People would bring their cars to town Saturday morning and then go back home only so they had a place to park Saturday night.
Wow.
It was not uncommon that the streets would be crowded till midnight with people sharing stories, visiting, having an adult beverage or a Coke, eating peanuts, just sitting and talking, something that is lost quite a bit today. We do it on our cell phones and by email, and there's something to be said about just sitting around and chewing the fat as it used to be. And that's how a lot of these towns were. And we've lost some of that small town community feeling in a lot of cases. But that's how the town really had that neighborhood. And quite a bit of it still exists. I mean, you go in there's three places, I call them the old guys' coffee clubs, around town that still happens quite a bit. I mean, they go in, they have their group, they sit, they chew the fat. And some of that still exists in our town, and it's a very hometown feeling still, quite a bit. But it has grown, it has changed. We have different businesses in now, more transient folks. They live here, but they go to work in other cities, due to convenience and where corporations are. But it still has a small town feel, even at 150 years old.
Well, you're definitely a walking wealth of information. Want to remind everybody, we're talking to Doug Poor. He's a lifelong resident of Harrington. He's written a new book. It's called Harrington Through Time, A Hometown Story. What makes Harrington special? If somebody walked up to you on the street today and said, why Harrington? What makes your town so special?
I think it is that small town feel. Neighbors helping neighbors. When I grew up as a kid, one of my favorite stories is there was a group of little old ladies that lived on my block. And I was like 6 years old when mom sent me to the local market to buy whatever it was. And it never occurred to me until a few years after that, why all the old ladies were out on their porch. Because mom had called them all to make sure I crossed the street the right way.
to make sure that you were doing what you were supposed to do.
And God forbid, even as I got older and would screw up as every kid would do, the stories would beat me home.
Yeah, okay? You still had to go home to mom.
And answer for those stories.
Exactly.
Absolutely. but so that, whether it's in our churches or in our fire company, that town, that sense of town and community still very much exists here. And that's what makes Harrington. A couple just moved in recently to town and purchased the old Wheeler's Park property, and they're redoing it as a green space to let people visit. But that's what they have said. They've already fallen in love with the place, and it's because of that kind of sense of community and belonging that we seem to offer, and a lot of small towns do. We're not alone in that, but it's certainly a nice thing to see.
What's the population of Harrington?
It's about 3,900 people right now, give or take, maybe 4,000.
Walk me through the book, if you will. We're talking again to author Doug Poor. He's a lifelong resident of Harrington, and he's written a book, Harrington Through Time, A Hometown Story. Walk me through the book. You were gracious enough to send me a copy. I must admit, with my busy schedule, I haven't had time to read it properly. I've thumbed through it. I've noticed there's a lot of old-timey pictures. Where did they come from?
Most of them came from our museum here in town, the curator of which I am, and they were gracious enough to let me use them. The photos came from them and from citizens, some from the state archives, who has a large collection of our photos, and Hagley Museum as well. But most of them we have in our museum. We've been blessed over the 40-plus years it's existed that citizens would leave stuff to the museum, would want to keep that history here. So I sorted through them with a lot of input from members of the historical society, what we liked and what I knew was still here. That's what that book tells, is a story of what it looked like in 1880 or in 1920, and then what it looks like today. And that's what that book is based around.
What are you most proud of besides the overall book? I mean, this is your first book, right?
It's actually the second. I did another one for a sister publisher of this company. And it's a pictorial history. I'm actually under contract for 7 total books with them. I just submitted my next one, so you and I can chat again on the railroad history of Delmarva, which is just fascinating to read and to learn more about how it changed the whole peninsula. It's just an amazing story, and that's proof with our town.
What was your first book?
The first one was it was a pictorial history of Harrington. It was different black and white pictures than most of what's in the book, and it told more of the history of the town. From that aspect, and it stopped in about 1970 as far as photos went. So this kind of picks that up and continues on to a modern time. So they're kind of, they play off one another very well.
All right, so what are you most proud of? I mean, you're an author, you're very well known in the town of Harrington, I'm sure. What are you most proud of, Doug?
Gosh, that's a tough question, because I'm not like that kind of person. I would have to say, personally, just my community service and my service for the time I've been involved with the fire company and as a paramedic. Very few people, as I say, get to make a difference in people's lives, and I've been able to say that over my personal career. As far as my involvement in the community is just that. It is listening. I love sitting back and listening to the, and I hate to say the word old-timers, but you get what I mean. We've invited them into the museum, or I go to the senior center and visit with some of them to listen. And I just absorb the stories, and they are so cool to listen to them talk about the old steam engines that would come to town. Because then you can watch them, their eyes light up, and they have a blast talking. And I just get I get the privilege of sitting there listening to these folks relive this stuff, and it's wonderful to do.
What else do you want people to know about your book?
That the profits from the book, and I shouldn't say they're profits, all the books that I am writing, the proceeds are going back to the museum. I'm not going to make my own private island out of any of this. Not that I could anyway, off the residuals. But we're using profits from the book to expand the museum. We're looking at about a $1.2 to $1.5 million expansion project that we've just started. Because of the wonderful generosity people have shown to us and the artifacts they've given us, and people are getting more involved in genealogy and wanting to know their own history, we need that room. I told them as I wrote these books, as I asked for permission to use these photos, that's what my goal is to give this back to the community, to give the community that icon of its city that it can be proud of for generations to come, long after I'm gone.
I have my copy of the book. Where can people get a copy of the book?
They can either log on to ArcadiaPublishing.com and just search Delaware, and there's about 6 pages in the books there. Or they can visit us at the museum, and that's what we encourage everybody to do. Not that I love people asking me to sign them, and I chuckle. I'm like, yeah, my signature's not going to add to the value. Trust me. This is not going to.
The price will go up and up and up.
Edition. please visit us at the museum. That way you can see a lot of this stuff firsthand. You can ride around the town. There's a little app called Clio. It's an app that museums like ours that are small can create walking or riding tours around town, and we've created one with a lot of these places so they can go visit them and spend a day visiting our town, seeing the businesses, seeing the places. So that's what's great about the book is it promotes that as well, and it gains the museum some financial assistance as well.
Thanks to author Douglas Poor and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. And we cap off this edition of The Green next with the latest episode of the Direction Democracy podcast from the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we close the show with the latest Direction Democracy podcast from the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication. The podcast is part of the Center for Political Communication's National Agenda Series, Direction Democracy, which this fall examines where we've been, where we're going, and the current state of democracy in the United States. On this episode, I'm joined by the UD Center for Political Communication's Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director, Lindsay Hoffman, and David Redlosk, Chair of the University of Delaware Department of Political Science and International Relations, who is spending his sabbatical this fall in Iowa tracking the presidential race there. Here's the podcast. It's been edited slightly for time.
Since we have David here, we want to start with you and kind of pick your brain about the presidential campaign and what you're seeing on the front lines in Iowa. And I want to start with what we've opened the last couple of shows with, which is impeachment. And in this case, asking you, David, as you watch the Democratic candidates interact with voters in Iowa, is impeachment a big deal to them? Is it a top issue, or is it something that's just kind of the political class is really interested in, but the average person may not be as?
The answer is a little of both in a way. Voters are not asking about impeachment in the Q&A sessions with presidential candidates, but if you listen to the crowd before and after, there's discussion amongst voters about what's going on in Washington, what they've been hearing, remembering that the people I'm hearing are generally fairly strong Democrats in the first place, or they wouldn't be going to Iowa caucus events. But I have been struck by the fact that the question of impeachment, or a question asking the candidates about impeachment, I have yet to actually hear.
And I guess there is, we've kind of talked about this before, that there may be kind of a disconnect between, you know, those of us who follow it closely and see like the kind of drip, drip, drip of news coming out of, you know, the transcripts and the closed-door hearings and what the average person who's just kind of getting up each and every day is thinking about.
I think people in Iowa are accustomed to themselves being in the spotlight at this point in a presidential campaign. So I think they're more focused on the role that they perceive to be as an important one for them to play.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, Iowans take this role very seriously. You know, Iowa has now been the first event in the nominating system since 1976, so we're in the 44th year of that. And Iowa voters, in the research I've done over the years, are much more engaged, involved, and paying attention to all of this. But in particular, the idea that they are kicking this off runs really deeply. And a great way to compare this, a few years ago, we looked at whether voters voted strategically or sincerely in primaries. And what we mean by that is a strategic voter is someone who worries about who can win, who can be nominated and who can win.
Electability,
essentially. Viability, electability. Mm-hmm. The sincere voter votes their true preference without worrying too much about whether that candidate can win or not. What we found is that Iowa caucus goers actually vote sincerely at a much higher rate than later primaries, even New Hampshire, even Super Tuesday states. So they take it seriously and they really do try to send a message to the rest of the country, not about electability, but about who they think is the right candidate.
Before we go a little bit more into what's going on the grounds in Iowa, I do want to take this to a practical level, presidential politics, yeah, impeachment, and Iowa. Listening to the NPR Politics podcast earlier this week, they touched on the possibility that many of the senators who are running could be forced away from Iowa, close to the caucus, to serve as jurors at a Senate impeachment trial, suggesting that that could be a real nightmare for the campaigns. You know Iowa. How much would that hurt Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, if they had to walk
away. Michael Bennett. Don't forget Michael Bennett.
That's right. And I guess conversely, how much would that help a Joe Biden or a Pete Buttigieg who can stick around?
That's a good question.
It's a really good question. And I think by the time we reached, let's say, January, which would be it wouldn't happen sooner than January, but by the time we reach January, these candidates will have been in Iowa literally hundreds of times, literally for hundreds of events each. And, everyone will have seen them 4 or 5 or 6 times. So does it matter whether they're physically there or not? I don't know. I mean, this is unprecedented.
Right.
We're used to the intensity of the campaign ramping up in the last week or two. If it doesn't ramp up the same way, it might be advantageous to Buttigieg. It might help Joe Biden just because when people are looking for events to go to, that's who will be there. In some sense, Nancy Pelosi kind of controls this schedule. When does this come to the floor of the House? When is Trump actually impeached? At that point, then the Senate controls it, presumably McConnell, but it also, the impeachment is actually, the trial is actually the Chief Justice presides over. I'm sure McConnell would be happy to do it in January if Trump were impeached by then. It seems to me in some ways that politically, at least for the campaigns, it might be better if the House just waited a little bit longer. But I think in the end, we really don't know how it would play out.
And I guess, Lindsay, I'll ask you this, and Dave, you can weigh in if you want as well. I mean, in this day and age where you can be present electronically, a video town hall or something like that, is that something that we have any feeling for what would resonate with voters, that they go, okay, well, they can't physically be here, but they're gonna talk to us, or is that connection really important?
I'll say, put this in the context of our speaker that we had this week, former Governor Chris Christie. I can say that certainly being in the same room with him was very different from watching him on YouTube or as the YouTube governor or whatever. I can say the same thing about Joe Biden. I'm sure Dave can say the same thing about just being in the same room with a person helps you to see the humanity in them, helps you kind of identify like, oh, that's just another person. It's not this character that I see on screen.
No, I think that's exactly right. There's nothing like literally being in the room. And then add to it that one of the relatively newer features is the selfie line. and particularly for Elizabeth Warren, this has become a thing.
It takes hours.
Yeah, it does. And at the Warren event I was at the other day, the organizer at the end, as Warren wrapped up, said, "We'll organize the selfie line here. I know that's what you're really here for." And she wasn't being ironic or anything else. I mean, they wanted to hear Warren speak, but they really want their picture. Can't do that so well, if the candidate is not
actually with the screen,
in the room.
Does it?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's a little meta.
It is.
That is true.
Let's stay with Iowa, but step away from impeachments. And David, we want to talk to you a little bit more about what you're seeing on the ground there. Let's start. We've talked about him a little bit. Joe Biden. What are we seeing from Biden in Iowa? It seems like there is now kind of a disconnect between Biden in the national polls and Biden in the Iowa polls. How is that playing out on the ground?
Well, it's one of the things that's happened in Iowa for Joe Biden is he hasn't actually been there a lot compared to other candidates. And in particular, Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders have been there a lot more than Joe Biden. Elizabeth Warren's only been there a little bit more. But, it's really hard to connect with Iowa caucus goers if you don't go to Iowa a whole lot. And he hasn't been. I think they're ramping it up. I've seen more events lately. But whatever the strategy was for not physically going there, I think it's not a good strategy.
Well, and what about Kamala Harris? She was supposed to
be living in Iowa.
Yeah, move to Iowa. Has she been
there?
She
did say that, but there's no evidence that she's actually moved to Iowa, even in the sense that she's holding some substantially greater number of events, activities. She's in some real trouble financially, and I expect we will see her even more in Iowa now because she's all but shut down her other operations. And Iowa's kind of her last stand at this point. But, the really interesting thing, to go back to Joe Biden, the really interesting thing about him is that the larger scale events, he just doesn't come across that well. Again, if you put him in a multi-candidate event with Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg, you know, they are stronger speakers in that context. They get larger crowds and so on. But if you put him in a smaller scale event, he's absolutely excellent.
Right.
He's really, really good at connecting with people. The media makes fun of it to some degree, and they shoot pictures sometimes that kind of make it look a little weird. But if you're in the room, if you're seeing it happen, I think it's really very effective.
Yeah.
Iowa was not great for Biden in 2008, no. And that was kind of essentially where it all ended for him, finishing fifth.
That's what I was going to ask is, and I don't mean to interrupt, but is there some Biden fatigue in Iowa?
Well, I'm not sure that's the case. In 2008, he was one of eight or so candidates. Right. And, you know, you had Obama, you had Clinton, and you had Edwards, and no one else was going to break out of that troika in that cycle. A sort of funny story, but we were at the University of Iowa at that time, and it's in Iowa City. It's right downtown. My wife, Alicia, was working in an office right next to downtown, basically. And as she went in one day, there was Joe Biden on the corner just talking to anyone who come by. And as she went to lunch, there was Joe Biden still on the corner. Wow. I don't know if he'd moved in between, but it seemed like he'd just been there for hours talking to anyone who came by. But it just didn't pay off. However, we became vice president. He came back to Iowa as vice president, and Iowa Democrats absolutely adored him. It got as much, you know, attention as Obama did. I mean, they absolutely adored him. So I think he had every reason to think coming in this time around off that vice presidency would be a different thing than it was in 2008.
Having said all that, is there a sense of what he needs to do in Iowa this time around to be okay?
Yeah. Well. So I actually, and I've talked to his, one of his key staff guys in Iowa is a former student of mine at the University of Iowa.
Oh, wow.
And we were talking about this. And I said, you know, in many ways, you actually don't necessarily want to be the front runner going into caucus day because you can't surprise. There's nowhere you can go. What matters in Iowa is a lot more about grabbing the media's attention in a positive way than it is about winning. And how do you do that? You surprise. You do better than expected. You go in as the front runner. You're almost certainly not going to do better than expected. You go in polling third and you end up second, or you go in polling fourth and you end up second, and all of a sudden you're getting attention. So in many ways, what Biden mostly has to do in Iowa is not drop out of probably the top three. That's really the story at this point.
We've talked about Biden. We talked a little bit about, we heard you talk about Kamala Harris a little bit. So how about some of the other candidates there? I guess specifically Pete Buttigieg, who seems to be the one who's gaining some momentum there now. Just kind of give us a little sense of, you know, the state of play right now with the rest of the candidates.
So one of the interesting things about Buttigieg is his polling nationally is dramatically different from his Iowa polling at this point. And it does point out, again, the being there part, it really points out when you're running a campaign, when you're organizing, when you're actually there, voters have a different impression than they do when there's this generic question nationally, who do you support, and you haven't seen a campaign yet.
Well, and he's also campaigning as a Midwesterner, as someone who hunts and, you know, has a lot of things in common with Iowans.
Well, the other thing he's started doing recently, and I don't know if this is effective or not, to be honest, but he is tying himself to Obama in an interesting way. So he was at he did a big outdoor event in Des Moines a couple weeks ago now, and his introduction was all about how the introducer talked all about how we're in a situation we were in before this young new face has appeared, and made these parallels to Obama's rise in Iowa and to Obama himself, and then Buttigieg did as well, and that's particularly striking some people positively, other people rather oddly, because one of the really interesting things about him, he's doing well in Iowa, but he's polling at close to zero with South Carolina African-American voters. And they make up 60% of the electorate in South Carolina. Wow. So the question is, he could maybe do really well in virtually all white Iowa, but still face a pretty significant roadblock very quickly after.
I want to finish this particular piece of what we're talking about with asking you, What should people know about Iowa that they don't know? As they're watching all this happen, what should they know that maybe might inform, okay, well, now I understand why I'm seeing this kind of dynamic or I'm seeing this type of story or something like that?
So Iowa, particularly these days, is seen as a fairly conservative state. The Republicans, you know, Trump won it by 9 points. The Republicans control the state government. That wasn't true in the last decade. Actually, the Democrats made gains every single year, had control of the state government and so on. But right now it's seen very conservative. And that tends to bleed over to how people think about Iowa Democrats. But in fact, Iowa Democrats are among the more liberal Democrats around. There is this strong progressive element. Bernie Sanders, you know, virtual success there 4 years ago points this out. Iowa Democrats are quite liberal. And in that sense, they're a better representation of the party ideologically than most people think they are. Hmm. So if we think about it from a political standpoint, that's kind of the way to think about it. Beyond that, you know, everybody's heard by now about the Iowa State Fair and fried things on a stick. But it's real. You should go. It's an amazing experience.
Well, this podcast is part of the Center for Political Communications, Direction, Democracy, and National Agenda Series, headed up by Lindsay. We've already name-checked the guest who was here this week a few times, former governor and former New Jersey governor Chris Christie, a UD alum, we should point out. I have to ask you, what are some of the things that kind of stood out for you from what he had to say the other night at Mitchell Hall and just his, you know, kind of his visit here?
His visit was great. My students really liked him, even the students who were maybe not for him or from New Jersey and maybe did not appreciate him. He was a really likable guy. It was a lot of fun. The event itself, he had some really interesting takes on the November 5th elections, particularly in Kentucky and Virginia. But I think what was really interesting is he very definitively talked about whether he would run for office again in a way that I haven't heard him talk so clearly about it. He basically was like, in 2024, if, you know, all these boxes are checked, you know, my wife's on board and all these things are checked off, I would run for president. And he said that's the only job I'd be looking for. That is the only one. I'm not running for Senate. I'm not running for any of these other things. I'm an executive. We'll have to see what happens. But I think, you know, nationally, I don't know if people – are there any national polls about him right now? Probably not.
Not right now.
But it'd be interesting to see the comparison because from my understanding, what happened with Superstorm Sandy was that this was like New Jersey's 9/11 is what I've heard some people describe it as. So that was why his popularity rating just shot through the roof, much like George W. Bush's popularity rating after the real 9/11. So I think he had nowhere to go but down. And then when he had these several scandals, the beach photo, Bridgegate, I think New Jerseyans were not really pleased with that. We were just looking at some polling out of Eagleton. This was how residents feel about Governor Christie in 2008. And about half of them, the wording is so funny, about the half of them said, they're glad to see you go. Don't let the door hit you on the way out. About 45% said, some of it was good, some of it was bad, but thanks for your service to the state. So there are some people that appreciate what he was doing. However, only about 5% said, we're going to miss you. So,
and the context on that was Christie himself told the media, you know, you're going to miss me.
Yeah.
And so Eagleton decided to actually ask, are we going to miss him?
That's a fun poll. Yeah. I like that one. Yeah. But I think that, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, you never know what's going to happen. I think Christie's a story that's not finished yet. I don't know what necessarily he's going to do, but he wrote his first book. He is still friends with the Trumps, and he's still making commentary on ABC News and on other outlets. So I think his story is far from over, and things can change just as dramatically as they did during his governorship.
Am I allowed to interject here that there is one other job he would want?
Yeah.
And that is a sports talk show host?
That's
true. Probably true. Yeah, yeah.
And then if someone offered him that job,
in New York,
sort of
auditioned
for it. That would discourage him from running for president?
Yeah, it might.
That's very true.
Is that possible?
It might.
That's a thought.
It might be. He loved to go on the radio even when he was governor and talk sports.
Or maybe like run a Bruce Springsteen Sirius channel or something. There's probably already one.
The problem is he's a Cowboy fan, which really hurts him in a lot of places.
It does. It does. And that was one of the things, you know, I was directing the Rutgers Eagleton poll for much of Christie's tenure. I left there in 2016, so this poll that Lindsay just talked about was after me.
And we're so happy you came to Delaware.
But it was fascinating to track him. It was fascinating to look at his support. There's this belief now in retrospect that he was somehow wildly popular before 2012. Because he talked last night at the public event about being begged to run for president. You know, the money people were sitting down, which is true. But it wasn't because he was somehow overwhelmingly popular in New Jersey. He had, I think, in fact, a more positive national profile at that point than he did in the state. And then as the storm which just devastated New Jersey, areas have still not recovered. And he was bipartisan. He was a leader. He seemed strong, you know, in the face of all of this. And, you know, he shot up to record high polling for a New Jersey governor. Tom Kaine was the previous record holder, universally beloved, just about. And Christie hit that point and then squandered it, or his staff squandered it, depending on whose story you believe. And then it just collapsed from there. The fascinating thing is it didn't go back to that kind of 50-50.
It just kept going.
It just kept dropping. Mm. Yeah.
Well, we finish up, as we always do, with our political quick take. Yeah, we say hot quick take, quick hot take, whatever you want to do. David, we'll start with you. What is on your mind as your political quick take?
Looking at the polling in particular, and I think the recent Siena poll, New York Times poll, for example, that looked at a set of battleground states and suggested a toss-up in all of these battleground states. But I think one of the things that is a real challenge is polling these states is extraordinarily difficult. If you dig further into the methodology, and they're very transparent. It's really important that good polls are very transparent. But they all but admit that the Michigan polling is completely uncertain, that it's highly dependent on the assumptions that they make, much more so than usual. I think a lot of Democrats are looking at this and going, oh, my God, we're going to lose no matter what we do. But at the same time, I think everybody should just relax about anything having to do with head-to-head national polling for 2020. We're a year away. The correlation between 2020 national polls and the actual outcome a year ahead is close to zero.
Thank you.
So relax. Don't worry about it. Pay attention to what's actually happening.
You made Lindsay's day.
Yeah.
And you still have a political quick take to do.
I do. Well, since Christie kind of took my time at the event, I wasn't able to do my quick take at the event. So I thought, okay, I'll do it today. Cancel culture. This is this new phenomenon. Even former President Barack Obama spoke up about it last week. He said, the world's messy. There are ambiguities. People who do really good stuff have flaws. And he says, you don't have to be always politically woke. Get over that. And that's not being an activist. So this brings me to someone I follow on Twitter who I find really fascinating, primarily because she's about my age, is Monica Lewinsky. And in 2015, she famously said, I was patient zero of losing a personal reputation on a global scale, almost instantaneously. And she's absolutely right. She was patient zero for cyberbullying, for cancel culture, for all of these things that we're seeing, these phenomena now. She was literally the first person canceled online for almost 20 years. But since then, she's actually played a public and often self-deprecating role. She has almost 700,000 followers on Twitter and that coveted blue check. She also has just released a new anti-bullying campaign called The Epidemic and is working with a new anti-bullying Twitter tool called the Goodness Bot, where if you see an abusive tweet, you can reply to it with that at Goodness Bot and it will turn it into a positive tweet. But even with all these accomplishments related specifically to online shaming and canceling, Lewinsky's still not immune to being called out. So I found it really funny when journalist Yashar Ali, a freelance journalist, basically asked on Twitter, how different in age are you willing to be with a significant other? And her response in a very funny way was like, pass. I'm not going to answer that question. And then the Washington Examiner the next day, headline says, Monica Lewinsky pointedly declined to weigh in on an online discussion about the acceptable maximum age difference for two people in a relationship. And of course, they go on to describe, Lewinsky became nationally known in the 90s for having an affair with then President Bill Clinton while she was a 22-year-old intern in the White House and he was 49. So she retweeted that and laughed it off with some crying emojis. But it just goes to show you that even patient number one is still a target. And I say if Monica Lewinsky can laugh off cancel culture, I think we can all do it. I think we should make social media a respite from all that anger and hatred. Let's have fun with it. And maybe we can actually cancel culture. Let's make it as fleeting as the latest meme or any other internet phenomenon. Okay, boomer?
Nice touch at the end.
Thanks to UD Center for Political Communication Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director Lindsay Hoffman and David Redlosk, Chair of the University of Delaware Department of Political Science and International Relations, for their time on the Direction Democracy podcast, produced by the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication and Delaware Public Media. This podcast and more about the Center for Political Communication's Direction Democracy National Agenda Series this fall can be found at cpc.udel.edu. And a reminder, the next Direction Democracy National Agenda Series event is November 20th with John Della Volpe, who directs polling at the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics. That starts at 7:30 at UD's Mitchell Hall. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, University of Delaware professors Lindsay Hoffman and David Redlosk, and the Direction of Democracy podcast, and Delaware Public Media Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.